Take a network break. Welcome to episode 53. Grab a coffee and a virtual donut and join us for an analysis of the latest IT news, vendor moves, and new product announcements. We'll separate the signal from the noise, or at least make some noise of our own. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me as always is Greg Farrow. And today we have a special guest, Mike Fratto. He's the principal analyst for enterprise network systems at Current Analysis. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Drew. How are you?
Very good. Glad to have you on the show. And just before we get started, this week's show is sponsored by Sonos Networks. If you're looking to embed intelligence and security into your network, start with Sonos. All right, so jumping into the news, Apple made some announcements this week, so I feel we've got to do some obligatory Apple announcement coverage. One thing that jumped out to me is they launched a new iPad Pro, and that seems like pretty clearly an enterprise play, which is interesting for Apple because they've sort of ignored the enterprise for so long.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. The iPad is a iPad Pro is a 12.9-inch, uses a pencil, and has an external keyboard. As a lot of people have pointed out, it's like, hey, a Microsoft Surface, but Apple made it.
All fine. The innovation of Microsoft, but now with Apple styling.
I looked at it and thought, you know, it's probably going to be pretty awesome. I mean, the Microsoft product is probably better suited to enterprise customers. The kickstand is better and the keyboard's probably better, but I don't think they have the level of finish and capability that Apple has. I think the mistake Microsoft made was to try and put Windows into a tablet and have the same operating system, and it kind of failed. And iOS is a better tablet. Now, and notably, Microsoft was on stage demonstrating Microsoft Office on the iPad Pro. So that's a big turnaround from where we were just 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Some notes from a story that we'll have a link to in the show. The iPad sales are down 13% and 18% from a year ago. So I think Apple sees the enterprise market an opportunity to maybe tweak some of those sales, keep Wall Street happy, and clearly the partnership with Microsoft means that Apple is looking at the enterprise.
I'm not so sure. I think there's multiple things happening here. I don't think an iPad needs to be replaced every 2 years like an iPhone does. And people are benchmarking it against that because the iPad is not your first screen. It's a second screen for most people. So people who own an iPhone might own an iPad.
You mean at home?
Yeah, at home. Or the iPad sits in front of the TV and it doesn't have the same, you know, as this is a very broad, I'm making very broad brushstrokes here. It's different for every person. I have an iPad. It's 2 years old. I have no intention of replacing it with anything in the next year or two. I don't need to replace it. So I think sales slow off because it doesn't need to be replaced constantly. I do think the iPad Pro, though, is going to find an interesting market, not in the enterprise, but in the mid-size market. In the enterprise market, having the iPad come in and have iOS as a managed desktop and to try and apply, everybody's going to want to put Kaspersky's antivirus or Symantec antivirus and asset management. And, of course, iOS doesn't have any of that. So it's going to be very hard for the iPad Pro to break into the enterprise on that basis. But the flip side is mid-sized businesses who don't have that type of stuff or small businesses are probably going to pick this up in droves. That ultimately is a far more profitable market than dealing with the enterprise who theoretically think spending $300 on a crappy HP Dell low-end laptop made out of recycled plastic that they scraped out of the bottom of a rubbish bin. You know those rubbishy laptops that big companies give you, Drew?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I used to have one.
Yes. Runs awful. I think small businesses are going to buy an iPad Pro and find a use for it. I was watching something today, reading an article today from a designer. Do you know the Cintiq tablets that people use to draw? They use pens and all that sort of stuff. And that market is fundamentally locked up by Cintiq. And they're saying that this unit, an iPad Pro, is one-third the cost of a good-sized Wacom Cintiq tablet. And so you could just buy one of these as a tablet entry device and you'd be away.
The Cintiq tablet, that's the Wacom tablet that has the you actually draw on the glass, you draw on the image. Yeah.
There's several things wrong with it. One is that when you bring the pencil across it, it's very slow, so the drawing doesn't follow the pen because they're underpowered. Wacom's trying to extract too much profit out of the market, and they've underpowered the tablet itself. They've used very thick glass, so the pencil's not on where the stroke is, so you have to mentally adapt. So it doesn't have the true expressiveness of a proper, whereas the iPad has this super thin, you know what Apple's like when it comes to display technology. The pencil is right on top of the glass and right underneath that is the surface. So the pencil looks like it's a pen on paper. So it's much stronger for graphical purposes or drawing purposes, and that's going to make it easier for handwriting, for stuff like that. And of course, don't forget iOS 9, split windows, better multitasking, blah, blah, blah. So it's going to be much more desktop-like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense.
Oh, and don't forget, IBM and Cisco and Apple have all done partnerships to do something in the enterprise.
Yeah, we talked about this last week with Cisco and Apple buddying up a little bit.
But we've got no idea what they're going to actually deliver.
Right.
So, you know, turn the iPad Pro into a telephone, maybe. That'd be.
And there you go.
Yeah. A $1,200 handset. Oh, wait, that's what Cisco charges for a handset today.
Cisco way. All right, so moving on from Apple. Intel, I found this story on the New York Times this week. Apparently, they've been sponsoring Science Talent Search, which is a long-running, 73 years old, I think, effort to promote science in the United States. So Intel's been a sponsor. Kids do these amazing scientific research projects. There's a contest. Winners go to the White House. They get their photo with the president. You know, hooray, STEM education. Great branding opportunity for Intel. Intel is walking away, apparently. Really struck me as a strange idea. Is the semiconductor industry really in such trouble that Intel doesn't have the estimated 6 million it takes to run the competition every year?
Yeah, it's surprising, too, that they're not actually saying why they're walking away. You know, there doesn't seem to be any reason to it. So it's, yeah, very, very curious what's going on there.
And it also opens the door to another wealthy tech titan to step up and get a PR victory by saying, hey, we'll do it. Yeah, let's put our name on this, you know, STEM talent search for young people. Let's go for it.
I think it would be a good fit for a VC firm like Greylock or, you know, one of those guys to sort of step in.
Mm, they don't give out money, though. They
Well, not without a return, but, you know, with the money they're making. I think it would be an interesting thing for them for a VC to do.
You've got a problem here. As companies get bigger and bigger, and like Intel has grown substantially in the last 10 years, they're giving $1.6 million annually. They're probably spending $500,000 just to monitor that compliance with that. And it's just not big enough to make it worth continuing. They probably have a whole bunch of obligations to provide headcount and stuff and time and resources, and that's just not worth continuing, I would guess. It's just not big enough a donation to make it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you consider that Intel's giving away $500 million a year in venture capital funding. Maybe you just got to see it in that terms, you know.
Obviously, there must be a business reason behind it and a good financial reason. But when you talk about promoting kids and technology in the United States and walking away from that, it just kind of feels like, ooh, really? You want to do that?
Most likely it's just too hard to manage.
Yeah. I guess. Yeah. So Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, there's a PR opportunity waiting for you.
1.6 million, there's some billionaires out there who could do that out of their own pockets.
That is very true. Some other news, Verizon and Cisco are teaming up on SD-WAN. I guess Verizon is going to be reselling Cisco's IWAN product as a service.
I looked into this a little bit more closely, and if you read into the article a little bit more deeply and then read around a little bit, there's a business unit inside of Verizon that manages services for some companies. And that business unit manages the Cisco networks of people, and those people probably looks like, and now here's where I get into the area of speculation, those people that Verizon managed services manage have said, please go and give me a Cisco IWAN. And so now Verizon's buying IWAN, which it probably isn't at all, it's managing a Cisco IWAN network for a customer. I don't think it's actually selling a managed service based on IWAN.
Mm, okay, I guess that is a distinction.
Now, keep in mind here, too, that Viptela did a deal with Verizon in May this year. So Viptela and Verizon partnered with Viptela. I've put a link in the show notes. And Viptela also did a deal with Singtel to launch a software-defined service back in the same time frame, February to May this year. So Cisco's a little bit behind the leading edge on this SD-WAN stuff. But like them, it's not Verizon deploying Cisco IWAN or Viptela into their core network to replace MPLS. There's a business unit inside of the company that does a thing, and it's taking that product on board to do that thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would probably be Verizon Business. That's where their security, the managed security services, managed data services, a bunch of that stuff. It's.
And so the customer that dictates the product, not Verizon.
Not really. It depends. I mean, they're offering a suite of services from their own portfolio of now apparently IWAN will be part of that portfolio. If they've already got ISRs out of the customer prem, then you know it's kind of a no-brainer for them to do that.
It'll look really simple. IWAN's got a long way to run before it gets as integrated and as valuable as some of the competitors. Not because it's wrong, it just hasn't got that. It's like a bag of Lego blocks that need to be assembled by yourself, you know, a bit of IPSec, a bit of this, a bit of that. Compared to what the other companies are doing, it needs to, you know, get moving to be competitive. But, you know, as you say, if you've got Cisco WAN and you think you can build an SD-WAN, you might want to just keep working with your existing stuff and try to make it work.
Verizon has the experience and the expertise and certainly the funding to build up, you know, fill in any technology gaps that they have. So it makes sense. And IWAN is not particularly easy to use or, you know, for enterprises. So it actually, it makes sense if you're a Cisco shop and you want an SD-WAN service and you really kind of want it hands-off and you don't want to look at a startup.
I think it makes sense on paper. I think once people get to use it, they might regret not looking at a new solution.
From IWAN or what Verizon's managed service?
Yeah, if you're Verizon, you say, well, look, I've already got so much Cisco. Everybody knows Cisco. I'll go and buy Cisco's thing. But I think they might regret that when they start down the path of actually making it work. You really need a software platform to make IWAN come together that Cisco doesn't yet have.
Right, but that's what, you know, that's Verizon can build that. They already are. Verizon Business can build that within their managed service. They're already doing that.
Okay. I'll look forward to seeing a press release about that then.
And you think maybe they're hedging by also having a Viptela partnership, that they've got an alternative in their back pocket if the Cisco thing gets more complicated than they really wanted to get into?
You know, there's a business unit they've got. Here's how I would imagine it. There's a business unit, they've got Cisco, or their customer's got Cisco. Cisco's in there saying, you should go and buy some IWAN. So they say, yeah, that makes sense. We've got lots of Cisco. We'll just get some IWAN in here and start using that to make a better business unit without actually doing too much evaluation. So if I think back to my days working for F100 companies, they would say, we've already got Cisco. We're not walking away from Cisco. We've got a static partnership that's never going to change in the next decade. If Cisco IWAN is what they're calling SD-WAN, that's what we're going to go and deploy. That would be my bet.
Mm-hmm. I've got to imagine that the carriers also see SD-WAN emerging as an opportunity that they want to jump on as fast as they can.
It's a threat, actually.
Yeah.
It's a threat to what they do. There's always been, particularly in the U.S., I think a little bit outside in Europe and APAC, the relationship between customers and carriers has always been extremely hostile because carriers have historically been very, very slow to break up new services, very restrictive in what they can do. Mm-hmm. Problem resolution is a big problem. And IT is like an elephant. They remember everything.
Yeah.
There's sort of been this, you know, this sort of long push from enterprises, from organizations to basically do it themselves. They just want, they want a reliable pipe between sites or to the internet, and they'll build over the top. And so if you look at pretty much all the SD-WAN products that are out there, They do a lot of things, but they, you know, the big selling point is they're very simple and rather easy to use, compared to what was before, right? Instead of having to build out IPsec VPN networks and set up routing and all the rest of the stuff, these things are very simple. So it's easier for an organization to do an over the top SD-WAN and just continue to keep carriers as pipes.
As dumb pipes.
Yeah.
And carriers, they want to do more than just pipes.
Well, they think they do. The internet is already the vast majority of the bandwidth out there today, and we're already moving to a point where there's overlay networks being built for Internet of Things. SSL VPNs are becoming common. I mean, the people who make web servers are actually talking about just creating SSL VPNs from clients to servers, not just SSL encrypting a traffic, just make an entire VPN for the next version of HTTP. I don't think that they're, and the idea of having private bandwidth when you can go and get an SD-WAN appliance and just encrypt over the top of the band of whatever bandwidth underneath, whether it's private MPLS or public internet, it just doesn't make sense in the long term. If they want to defend their turf, sure, knock yourself out, but it doesn't make sense in the long term.
All right, something else to keep an eye on. Some other news coming out. A research company has noted that HP has finally outsold Cisco in cloud infrastructure gear, and I'm making air quotes that you can't see. This group, Synergy Research Group, they've been tracking, you know, infrastructure to help you build clouds. And I guess in this quarter, HP beat out Cisco by 0.5%, which is the first time that HP has come out on top over Cisco in this market tracked by this group.
I'd have to say, is this apples to apples? For what definition of the word cloud infrastructure are we talking about here?
That is a good question.
And I think this article says the same thing. You know, does it, you know, they're trying to compare HP, Cisco, Dell, Microsoft, and VMware, and EMC, and Oracle. It's like, oh, uh-huh, what, they all cloud? Are they, you know, like, so that's fairly imaginative analysis, shall we say.
Yes.
It looks like it's just revenue spend. It's just spend. It's not in any particular technology area. So, you know, this could be the impact of HP selling more servers. It could be declining sales of Cisco networking into cloud providers, you know, being taken up by Whitebox or other products. I mean, it's actually pretty vague. But if it's just money spend.
HP's got a lot of money in the cloud software market. So they bought, you know, Staccato. They have a bunch of orchestration systems around. They got Hellion around CloudStack. Hellion's sold a lot more than Cisco's Intercloud, as far as I'm aware. I could be wrong there, but Hellion's been, you know, greater volume if you're counting things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's hard to know if we're talking apples to apples, and we are also talking about 0.5 percentage point. So it's just an interesting headline.
Yeah, and it's only a 450-word article.
Right.
So it's you know, someone wrote the headline and then went with an article for it. I'm not sure that this is really valuable.
Yeah. No, you'd have to do, I think, deeper research, find out what's going on with particular technology sales, whether it's, you know, networking servers, software, what kinds of software, you know, storage, et cetera, in order to sort of suss out sort of who's winning, who's gaining and who's losing in that particular market.
Yeah, okay, so if we look at the source on Synergy Research, HP's cloud infrastructure leadership is due to dominating the cloud service segment and being a main challenger in storage, while Cisco's position is mainly due to its dominating the networking segment while rapidly growing its position in servers.
Yeah.
So it really is a mismatch. You'd have to read the report to make any strong conclusions.
Yeah. I mean, the conclusion from that write-up from Synergy is it appears to be really just revenue. It's,
yes,
you know.
But comparing storage servers versus networking servers doesn't seem to make sense. You need to see the details to validate the conclusions.
Yeah. Well,
if our listeners maybe have their hands on any reports or research that they've seen they think is a better indicator, let us know. Maybe leave a link on the website. This is probably a good time to talk about our sponsor, Sonos. They're bringing intelligence and security to real-time communications, including voice and video. They're not a startup. They've been around for a while. They offer hardware-based and virtualized session border controllers, diameter signaling controllers, and they have got SDN capabilities, policy routing servers, and media and signaling gateways. And I'm going to ask Greg to tell you guys about NAS IQ.
So NAS IQ is the operating platform. It's an application-aware platform that takes real-time control of network and application performance. So by having deep visibility into the applications on your network, you can start to control which way those application packets flow over your network. You can divert them over public infrastructure or private infrastructure. You can groom your voice versus your Oracle traffic and make sure that one or the other handle priority or offer latency-sensitive traffic of whatever sort it is. Sometimes it's just SSH. And you can also manage the overall network bandwidth intelligently, sending it where it needs to be and consuming the bandwidth in whichever WAN you have intelligently. The outcome is, of course, is that you reduce the need for WAN over-provisioning. Most of us just get over-provisioned WANs, barely using less than 20 or 30% of those pipes because we're provisioning for peak. NAS IQ and Sonos networks will be able to give you a way of managing it much more efficiently so that you can reduce your WAN pipe or at least not need any more of it while maintaining the quality for sensitive apps.
So if you want to learn more about how Sonos turns business connectivity into business continuity with NAS IQ, please visit www.sonos.net or call 855-GO-SONOS. That's 855-GOSONUS and tell them you heard about it on Packet Pushers. So getting back to the news, there's a bit of a spat going on between a couple of security companies, or at least one security company in particular, and some security researchers about vulnerability disclosures.
If there's one thing that makes me want to be a security researcher, it would be playing argy-bargy with security companies, because they seem to have, like, all the fun. I generally don't talk about security on the shows because it's really a specialist art, but this one's really cracker. So there's a company called FireEye, very popular in enterprise circles. What it has a sandbox idea. You put it at the gateway around where your proxy server or your DMZ is, and it scans traffic and it runs things in a sandbox. So if you can do anything to compromise that, you can quite often get to some nice corporate enterprise infrastructures if you can get over it, right? So a well-known security researcher discovers a bad vulnerability and goes, oh, look at that, and then proceeds to analyze it and goes, wow, actually that is pretty embarrassing because it's a fairly embarrassing sort of a vulnerability. They've actually got a pretty bad architecture. They've been running their web servers as root. So if you can compromise the web server of the FireEye appliance, you can actually get straight through. Not very good. This is a fairly consistent theme among security vendors. They don't secure the devices themselves very well. It's very hard to break out from inside of them, but if you can get to the administrative interfaces, they're often highly insecure, which still isn't very good. In the past, FireEye have been known to be very arrogant and very brash and very quick to make huge claims about their business, about how awesome and it's totally secure and it's the best thing ever to have happened. And so when this guy came up to them and said, look, I've got some disclosure here, I'd like to register these vulnerabilities with your bug bounty program so you can pay me for them, they said, we don't have a bug bounty program. So the researcher waits 18 months, like didn't just turn around, and announces that he's going to speak at the Black Hat conference. FireEye slaps a lawsuit on the researcher saying that, you know, you can't speak about these because you're making us look silly in public. And the whole security industry is up in arms, throwing hand grenades and generally burning down the buildings around FireEye. So it's pretty fun.
I feel like, you know, over the past 10 years or so, the industry has, you know, come to an uneasy understanding about how to do responsible disclosure, and that having a bug bounty program is better than finding out that your product has been wrecked by an exploit you didn't know about.
Well, it's a few things here. You know, now you've got people like Alex Stamos, chief security officer for Facebook, saying, I won't buy products from companies who do this type of stuff, without actually naming the company. And then even worse, you've got a lot of quite senior security figures now saying, this is not the way to do business, FireEye. You know, you should have a public disclosure program, bug bounty program, so people can report things. You certainly shouldn't be slapping lawsuits on researchers. Just because you look foolish from having a silly bug in your, you know, for having a bad thing in your software, that's not a reason to go around getting all huffy and making people's lives miserable.
What's surprising to me is I've been following this full disclosure, no disclosure, responsible disclosure since, you know, the early 90s. And whether or not a bug bounty program is a good idea, I don't know. I mean, it's good if you're going to reward people who find a problem with your software or your product and tell you about it and you reward them. It's, you know, it's nice. It's nice to do that. But more importantly, it's the behavior of some of these companies, and it's really surprising for a security company that the first thing they do is ignore the problem, ignore the researcher, and then when they're outed, you know, they go after them, you know, via legal means. You know, this is really just kind of unacceptable behavior, and you know, using things like the DMCA to go after researchers, trying to shut them down for giving talks. This is horrible. And frankly, these companies should be put out of business. Companies should not buy from them. Mm. You know, it's terrible, and that includes companies like Oracle, which has a horrible track record of fixing
yeah,
problems.
We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. They absolutely, she won't be around for long. Yeah,
what's her face?
Yeah, the chief security officer
chief
for
security
Oracle.
Officer.
She we talked about it extensively. Basically, said to people, don't come telling us about your reverse engineered code because we're going to give you a licensing breach notice.
You know, that kind of behavior is just it should be unacceptable. And unfortunately, no company's going to get rid of Oracle because of that. That's just not going to happen. But they should.
What surprises me is that, so let's assume that the security researcher, you know, is honest when they say they've been sitting on it for 18 months. They did reach out. They did try to go through proper channels. That
This security research is well known, has been doing this sort of thing. This is how he makes a living.
Right, right. Well, so I guess my one question there is, did he know going in whether FireEye had a bug bounty program or not? Because if you're doing this research because you want to make money for it, presumably then you would look at folks that are willing to actually pay for you and not have to
I'm not sure this guy, I mean, this guy's, he probably didn't do it for money, and at a certain point FireEye upset him, and so then he asked for money, and it just goes up from there. I mean, I accept the fact that if you're a certain type of American company, that paying people money is actually difficult at an accounting level. How do you decide how much to pay and what's a good price and who raises a purchase order? And we don't have budget for that and, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's any number of excuses. But there are companies out there like BugCrowd who'll do the whole thing for you. That you pay them a fixed fee, they'll handle the bug bounty, they'll validate the security researcher. You don't have to do it yourself. So FireEye had 18 months to solve this problem, build their own bug bounty program or outsource it to a bug bounty provider. They did nothing. They ignored it. They did nothing about fixing the weakness in the code, obviously either deciding internally that it's too hard or it's not really a problem that they need to address because it's only in the administrative interface or whatever the excuse is. But to then turn around and say, when he says, oh, well, I'll talk about it because I'm going to make something, I've spent time on it and I need to make a return, stands up, says he's going to stand up at a Black Hat conference and then to slap a lawsuit on him, that doesn't... That's no way to make friends in the security industry.
Absolutely, and that's the thing, that I could see a company outside of the security industry thinking, this is how we play, this is how we do it, we're going to go lawsuit. But to be part of the security community and to know the temperament of the security community and then take these steps is just mind-boggling. I mean, why would you stick your hand in the wasp nest? I don't get that.
Well, doesn't give you a whole lot of confidence in their management.
Yeah.
Well, the CEO of FireEye is known to be something of a he's not the sort of person the people here would have around to dinner, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. Well, we'll leave that there. Maybe we'll check in on it and see how it's going.
No, we won't.
Okay. Never mind. That's the last you'll hear of it from us.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So this story jumped out at me. We've been hearing a lot around SDN and things about network automation tools becoming more important. So Chef, which does a lot of automation, just got a $40 million funding round. And this is a Series E funding round, $40 million in a Series E. That was surprising to me.
Yeah, nobody wants to pay for automation. Unfortunately, they want it, they just don't want to pay for it. I've got a soft spot for automation tools. I really, you know, when I was working at the lab, it was only me. I had to automate just about everything. I mean, it's one of those technology areas that I think has just incredible potential. I don't think a lot of IT organizations are quite ready for something on the scale of a full automated data center. Maybe I'm talking to different people. Maybe I'm talking to companies that necessarily wouldn't be, you know, Chef's customers. But, you know, they tend to do rather targeted, sort of somewhat smaller projects, which you can do as Chef, but it's not something that they're necessarily going to spend money on.
Yeah, Chef was one of the first of these straight after the CF Engine people came out and before mm-hmm. Puppet came out shortly afterwards, and now Ansible's all the rage amongst networking people because we don't really, there's something doesn't echo with Puppet or Chef at this point in time. I think that ultimately open source as a business model is still uncertain. If your product is open sourced and you're using that as a way to generate leads for your business, so you say, I'm going to outsource this so people can engage with my product and I'll find a way to make money out of it later, like Red Hat style. Mm-hmm. Yet consistently for the last decade, we haven't seen too many open source businesses survive and thrive over the time, especially not when they're VC funded. You know, somebody's giving you $40 million, they're expecting a $400 million payout in a few years' time, right? 10 to 1 easily has got to be the number. You know, and if it's going to get a half a billion dollar valuation, it's got to be pulling down $100 million in revenue or $125 million in revenue. If I can get most of it on open source, there's not where's the $125 million in revenue to give you a $500 million valuation going to come from? So open source is one of these things where the business model around it doesn't seem to make sense. And the ability of these companies to monetize, is open source is toxic like that. So yeah, I'm like you. I can't see how it's going to survive.
Well, I didn't know. My issue wasn't necessarily with the business model. It was the fact that, you know, I would expect more uptake of automation and more opportunity for a company like Chef to be getting along without necessarily having to go for additional funding rounds.
Hmm. Who's going to buy them? IBM? And if IBM bought them, who's going to run away? Which is just about everybody. You know, because IBM's not exactly the glamour child these days. Nobody wants to be buying IBM's products or Oracle's products, really, if they can not, you know, get away from it. Nobody wants to work for the enterprise or with the enterprise. So I'm struggling to sort of understand how Chef manages to get a valuation that matches that sort of funding.
Yeah, and Mike, I guess I'd like to follow up. What do you think is the hesitation of organizations that you're talking to about embracing automation? Is they just don't know where to start? They don't see the value? They don't have the internal expertise or knowledge?
Yeah, all of the above. All of the above. It's, I think it's partly you got IT administrators who are thinking about doing automation, about doing more automation. They're willing to sort of take on that risk. They may not have necessarily the skill set, but it's something that they can learn how to do. I think you've got more established senior management, which are, you know, they've got the battle scars from 10, 15, 20 years. You know, they have processes that work. And so there's a very real concern that, you know, you start automating, if you're not careful, then, you know, things can run out of control. What, you know, which is very possible. I mean, you have to be extremely detail oriented. You know, you forget one little failure mode and, you know, you could be screwed. So I think there's...
Which,
there's
of course, is exactly what you got today with manual systems.
But I was going to say, yeah, a manual system and a whole bunch of homemade scripts and crappy documentation.
But you know how to deal with those, right?
Or at least maybe you don't know how to deal with them, but you just know that that's the way you've done things and you feel comfortable with it. Yeah.
No, that's not true. I know companies who've doing manual processes, systems that were deployed 5, 10, 15 years ago, nobody actually knows how they operate.
So maybe that's why they don't want to bring automation in, because they don't know where the heck to hook it into.
Well, I mean, you're talking different games here. I'm just saying that a lot of people actually don't do data center failover testing because they're frightened that it might blow up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And automating that, that's, you know, you're not even going to get started on that. If you're not testing your failover and you're not making any changes, because testing failover is actually making a change, if you've just frozen everything, automation is fearful. And that's the sort of people you're talking about, in my view.
What they have works. There's no driver to go change.
Let me see if I can put it this way. It sounds like you're saying there's kind of a level of operational discipline you need to get to make automation even feasible.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
rather
flexibility.
Than looking at automation to bring you up to a level of operational maturity.
Yeah. And that's why we generally see automation being associated with the cloud, is because once you're in the cloud, you've already, it's a new app or a new software platform, or you're developing it from the ground up. Mm. So you can use DevOps and automation and orchestration type practices. Retrofitting it to your old stuff is highly unlikely.
That makes sense.
Not impossible, just highly unlikely. Let me clarify, because it might go in the spreadsheet. Not impossible, just highly unlikely.
You know. Oh, the spreadsheet.
And it's certainly not going to stop some of our existing vendors putting good money on the table to make it work.
Last story for the day, the Open Networking Foundation, which is shepherding the OpenFlow specification, just launched some new testing specifications for version 1.3 of OpenFlow. And Mike, you were pleased to see this.
Yeah, very, because I'm a strong believer interoperation is far more important than sort of standards conformance, you know, in providing a level of assurance that product A is going to work with product B. And so things like standardized testing and certification programs go a long way, not all the way, but go a long way to providing that assurance. So I'm happy to see the ONF coming out with the 1.3 certification and testing.
Okay. And according to the story coming out of Network Computing, it didn't look like there was a lot of interoperability going on with version 1.0, so they're hoping to see this ramp up with 1.3, which obviously already has a lot of support from the big switch vendors.
Yeah. Yeah, and there wasn't a whole lot of adoption of 1.0. I don't think it among switch vendors. I mean, it was sort of dropped in there, but there wasn't a whole lot of uptake. I think with 1.3, there are far more capabilities which make OpenFlow much more attractive. Yeah, I think the ultimate thing that's going to the ultimate assurance is when you have a vendor who validates. They do validation testing against a particular product. And so you're looking at things like bake-offs between like HP, NEC, and others. if one of them can say, yeah, we work with this other product, we work with these, and they'll validate that, that's sort of the ultimate assurance. So the certification testing is one level, but then you're sort of above that is that vendor validation.
Yeah, I'm still a believer in OpenFlow. I still think that OpenFlow or flow-based technologies will exceed the capabilities of packet technologies. The last few weeks, we've seen the rise of IOVisor, which is an attempt to replace the Open vSwitch in the Linux kernel because people don't want flows in the kernel. There are certain vendors who have a vested interest in packet-by-packet handling, and they would like to support packet-by-packet management and so forth, which I think is, you know, no, but they can't convince me of why doing it that way is better than doing it flow. I can get some of it, but I'm not sure of it. So to see OpenFlow continuing to slowly progress at standard body pace, it's a bit like the usual standards bulldozer. It takes a long time to get there, but eventually, when the bulldozer finally arrives, you sure as heck know about it because it's built up so much momentum.
Yes. I have to say, for OpenFlow, I think in terms of a standard development, it seems to be going relatively speedy. I mean, when you think about the vendor adoption and stuff too, business model of do we really want to do this? I think OpenFlow is moving along nicely.
Yeah, arguably. I mean, the impact of OpenFlow has been blunted by Open Daylight and then the plethora of SDN controllers and then each vendor doing their own thing, the market going in 100 different directions, mm-hmm. Maybe 200 different directions. And then people attempting to break networking into WAN and data center and to balkanize the two. I still think we still have to see the entire network as, groups of smaller networks that gel together. So there's a one and a many aspect to network. So there'll still be a WAN. There might even be many WANs, different WANs that have different purposes. Having a common protocols underneath those many WAN models is going to be the thing. So, and ultimately, flows is how our applications work. We don't transfer data packet by packet. Our applications actually talk to each other in a stream of data flow going from point A to point B. And that's why I still believe at this point in time, I haven't had anybody convince me otherwise yet, that handling everything packet by packet in the network using the routers to do smart things, I don't believe that actually to be sensible.
So you're holding out hope for OpenFlow?
Well, it's not a case of hope. OpenFlow continues to win and continues to... The vendors, they're still key vendors throwing resources into flow-based technologies. It's not winning. It's hopeful. It's there. We're still waiting for the packet-by-packet stuff to come up with an answer from my point of view. The router vendors who are heavily incumbent with this, every packet comes in, packet goes out, munge each packet, continue to push that approach. But that seems obvious. That's what we already do. We can sell that, so let's sell what we've already got. Let's not make sure that we don't get into flow-based, because that would change our business models, and we don't want that.
I think one of the things that needs to happen with open flow-based products is there needs to be demonstration that they are as reliable as what we have today. There are a lot of FUD about the security around the controller, and that's a weakness, which is ridiculous. And there's FUD around, what happens if the controller goes away, and now my network is done and dumb and can't do anything. And there needs to be a lot more assurances put in place via demonstrations and proof points addressing a lot of those limitations, and that's going to start push it off.
Isn't it a shame that people don't have the technical competency to understand those discussions? Do you find, in your work, when I go around and talk to people about SDN controllers, they ask me those questions and I go, do you not they just don't understand the technological discussions or have a foundation in computer science to understand why those are not relevant.
Well, it's not even having a foundation in computer science, Craig. It's just simple operational management. I always like the question, doesn't the controller become a single point of attack and that's a security problem? And my question to those people are, do you put your NMS out on the internet right now? Can you get to it? No, you keep it in a protected zone. So why would your controller be any different? Do you put your routers out on the internet? I mean, do you take your internal network and do you expose them to the internet? No, probably not. Why would your controller be any different? And they're like,
yes.
Oh.
Well, my favorite one is to say, if I attack the routing protocols on your routers, would they still work? Because that's the same thing. The answer is each router with a routing protocol is far more susceptible, far more vulnerable than a controller.
Yeah, it's BGP is is fragile.
And buggy.
Yeah.
And fixing 250 buggy routers is a lot more work than fixing one controller that's having
so
a buggy.
So I think it's some of that. I think it's just sort of this operational inexperience and looking at the wrong things.
Yeah. Well, maybe it ties back to what we were talking about with automation, where this is different from the way we've done it, and so we are uncomfortable with thinking about a new way.
One of the big drawbacks of OpenFlow is that it's not, in some sense, it's not Ethernet.
It's greatest. It's saving grace, and it's a crutch.
Yeah. So I often say to people that OpenFlow is TCP. What you're actually doing is networking TCP instead of networking IP or layer 2.
Yeah.
Layer 3 or layer 2. You're actually networking at layer 4. And that seems to work. Certain people who, that seems to help some people. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a good way to look at it.
TCP is a point-to-point, stream-based way of exchanging data, and that's how OpenFlow works, conceptually. And you can have very coarse flows, you can have very micro flows, you can say source port, destination port, source IP, destination IP, or you can have very coarse flows, a subnet to a subnet, otherwise known as IP routing.
You can set up default flows, default actions. I mean, there's a lot of ways to address some of the supposed limitations in OpenFlow. And it really needs to have, but those are the kinds of things that I think network IT and IT folks and IT management sort of need to understand, is a lot of this stuff can be addressed very simply, or not simply, but can be addressed today.
And of course, the challenge here is that incumbent vendors who are publicly listed need to deliver a return quarter on quarter. They don't see a 3-year horizon to bring this to market. They want an answer this quarter to sell more products. By the end of, they could invest for almost 180 days. Two budget cycles would be, if we're not getting a return in 180 days, well, that would have to go to the CEO for approval, kind of thing,
Right. Yeah.
And that's literally, the market is demanding quarter by quarter returns. So building an OpenFlow change is just not going to put a return at the bottom line, and that's not the answer.
Issues. Well, I think it's good that if folks have been hearing these objections about OpenFlow and controller-based networking, they've now got some counterarguments.
Well, I don't know about that. They've got some opinions. Hopefully they're at home yelling at their headsets going, no, Greg, you're wrong, because that's – no, and that's exactly what I want. I want people to engage in the debate. That's what we need.
All right. Well,
engage in the education.
Yeah, engage in the education.
Go and read it up and tell me why I'm wrong. I'm here.
Gauntlet thrown. That brings us to the end of another scintillating episode of Network Break. Thanks to our sponsor, Sonos Networks. If you're looking to embed intelligence and security into your network, start with Sonos. Mike, thanks for joining us. Where can folks find you if they want to hear more from you?
So I'm on Twitter, at mfratto, M-F-R-A-T-T-O, or via email, mfratto@currentanalysis.com.
And Greg, where can people argue with you?
As always, on my blog at ethereummind.com, on the Twitter is at ethereummind, and also on other fine and not so fine social media sites like LinkedIn and Google+.
And I'm Drew Connery Murray. You can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM and see my blogs on packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening. Network Break, as always, is powered by Virtual Donuts, because we can't download real donuts to smartphones yet.
Damn it.
Yeah.